WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is Joyce Carol Oates. She's one of the most versatile and prolific American writers. Her novels include Them, Do With Me What You Will, Belle Fleur, and Maria, A Life. The critic Alfred Kazin has said of Oates' writing that it comes from someone who is dreaming all the time she's awake. Many of her characters lead everyday lives that end up filled with mystery and terror and often veer beyond control or comprehension. Joyce Carol Oates' latest book is an essay titled On Boxing. It's a meditation on the violent and controversial sport. She calls it America's tragic theater for the way it consumes the very excellence it displays. Joyce Carol Oates lives in Princeton with her husband Raymond Smith, with whom she edits the Ontario Review, a literary journal they founded. Since 1978, Joyce Carol Oates has taught creative writing at Princeton University. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I was surprised, and I think I certainly wasn't the only reader of yours who was surprised to find that you're a fan of boxing. How did you first become interested in the sport?
I became interested in it, in a sense, when I was really too young to know what it was or what it symbolized or really anything. I was probably quite a young child, younger than 10. My father took me to Golden Gloves tournaments in Buffalo, New York. And I think, like most children who are brought to some new and somewhat mysterious world by a parent, it came to me with the force of a revelation. It wasn't that I was assessing it or critical of it or even in a way a fan, but just that it seemed to perhaps symbolize something very arcane and mysterious and exciting, a kind of adult world.
What's your interest in it as a writer? Does it have literary significance for you?
Well, that really came much later. I've always been fascinated by certain elements in what one could say the human spirit in contention, a kind of divided self. And I'm also interested in just a phenomenon of twins, which in some unconscious way seems to be suggested by two boxers in the ring who are so well matched.
Some people think of boxing as exploiting our worst instincts, of being almost like the old gladiator fights. Do you think that that's a valid way of looking at it?
It's very hard to answer that. When I approached boxing, it was as a cultural phenomenon. As a novelist, I'm very interested in American history and American culture, what might be called loosely American studies. So I was approaching boxing from the outside as a woman and a feminist, and then someone who knew a bit about it because of my background. My father had been friends with a boxer, and he followed boxing quite assiduously, especially in the early 50s. And so it really grew or evolved from that in a kind of unplanned and in a way uncoordinated method.
But would you agree with the people who say that boxing exploits our worst instincts by having us cheer for people who are punching each other out?
I don't really know how to answer that. I think the idea of what art does for us or what sports do for us is very, very difficult. If we see an excellent production of King Lear, for instance, we're sort of transported beyond the surface, let's say. We are subjected to seeing a man whose eyes are being put out on stage and it's simulated. Then with boxing and with other sports that might be called blood sports or blood activities, some of the same aesthetic principles are going on there. It's a vicarious experience. I don't know if it exploits the passions of the onlookers or whether it exploits the passions of the participants.
I want to quote Michael Tyson. You quote this in your book. He's a boxer who said, "I tried to catch my opponent at the tip of the nose because I want to punch the bone into the brain." And he makes it sound like a craft, you know, like a cabinet maker might say about how they want, like to, you know, cut something to size so it makes a beautifully formed cabinet, except he's talking about punching a bone into a brain. What's your gut reaction to a quote like that?
It seemed to me just extraordinary, because you're quite right, Terry. He does approach boxing. He has been trained to approach it that way by a wonderful trainer named Castamato, who's sort of legendary in the boxing world. But to approach it as a skill, as a craft, as an art, with very carefully calibrated and designated parts of the body that one tries for. I suppose not unlike karate. Well, I thought it was very interesting because I've gotten to know Mike a bit. I'm not a close friend of Mike Tyson's by any means, but I know people who know him very, very well, and he's a very warm and, in a way, ingenuous young man. He can be very sweet. It's just that in the territory of the ring, another personality steps forward. I don't mean that it's a primordial personality, though it's probably fueled by that instinct. Because, in fact, boxing of the caliber of Tyson's is very, very highly trained. It's not instinctive, and it's not primitive. Boxing is not really an instinctive art. As I say, though, it's fueled by these rather instinctive emotions.
You mean by it's not instinctive? It's not instinctive because it's so disciplined. You have to know exactly what you're going for. You have to be in training. It's not just that, oh, I hate this guy, I'm going to punch him out.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's very highly trained. And in some ways, awkward, I think, to learn to be a boxer. One has to relearn or completely learn a whole different set of priorities, I think, in terms of leverage and timing and so forth. It's primarily the art of self-defense, or ideally it's supposed to be a self-defense. That is, one hits, but one doesn't get hit in return.
But then you have a quote in your book from Marvin Hagler who said, "When I see blood, I become a bull."
Hagler meant his own blood.
Excuse me?
Hagler meant his own blood.
Oh. I thought he meant when he saw the blood of his, when he saw a bleeding face in the ring, that he just wanted to make that wound even bigger.
I think that's probably true for most boxers. It's supposed to be an atavistic and absolutely irresistible feeling that when an opponent is bloody, that the sight of the blood just unleashes some other level of energy. But what Hagler meant was that, like all boxers who have been hurt, and Hagler's skin has been getting progressively thinner, he bleeds more easily. It's this characteristic of somewhat older boxers. He means that the fight may be stopped within seconds. Consequently, he has to knock his opponent out, or he may lose the fight on a technical knockout.
You have an interesting observation. You say that you think boxing is more about bearing the pain than it is about inflicting pain, and that it becomes more of a masochistic than a sadistic sport.
Well, words like masochism and sadism have to be really dealt with quotation marks around them, because they tend to be extremely abstract and, in a way, sort of careless words. Nobody knows what they mean exactly. And when I talk about masochism, I usually being somewhat speculative about it, because I think that writing is also a very masochistic activity. Perhaps
right.
Most of the things that we do that involve some kind of work and discipline and delayed gratification are masochistic. But obviously boxing, for most boxers, involves a good deal of pain. Even for boxers who are champions and who have triumphed, like Sugar Ray Leonard, much pain has gone into it. And the training alone is just so arduous, so onerous and difficult, that when I've seen Mike Tyson train and work out, and I've never really seen any human being exert himself like that, to the point at which sweat was just exuding from his pores, just as if his body were weeping, and yet he wasn't out of breath. And that's really a phenomenon. We don't usually see anyone in quite that state.
Have you ever seen a match in real time, not tape delayed or 10 years after the fact, but in real time, where you could tell and the viewers could start to tell that someone was in the process of being killed, yet the referee wasn't ending the match?
You mean, have I ever seen a live match when
mm-hmm.
someone was killed?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely not. No, those matches are very, very rare. Very rare.
But you've seen them on
tape
playbacks?
Well, I saw them deliberately on tape. I saw Ray Mancini and Duck Koo Kim. And I saw the Johnny Owen bantamweight fight of some years ago.
What was your gut reaction to that? Because as you were saying before, that kind of violence and that kind of death is very different than death in the theater, which we know is just fake. Yeah, this is real.
I deliberately saw those tapes by way of a friend because I was writing this book and I just wanted to address that subject, the fatalities in the ring, the dangers to the boxers. And strange as it may sound, it was because Johnny Owen and Duk Koo Kim were so courageous. They kept fighting, they kept getting up, they were knocked down. They were obviously being pushed beyond the limits of most human beings' endurance, where another boxer, or most boxers, would have given up, and these fights should have been stopped by the referees in each case. Where other boxers would have given up, they just kept on, and it was because of that they died. Duk Koo Kim was very evenly matched, as it turned out, with Ray Mancini. And when one sees the two of them fighting, the Korean boxer seems like a shadow self or a mirror self, a twin of Mancini. So it was a really eerie and uncanny fight. Before the match, some days before, Duk Koo Kim allegedly written on a lampshade in Korean, kill or be killed, which is presumably a slogan or a watchword of the martial arts, so that he thought of it as a fight to the death. He was willing to have it be that. Whereas Ray Mancini, I'm sure, was just defending his title.
When you were watching that fight, were you yelling at the screen saying, "No, stop it, stop it"?
Oh, no. To me, this was history.
Uh-huh, right.
And I find it very, very hard to see live fights, particularly fights of the caliber, say, of Mike Tyson's. I saw the Mike Tyson fight the other evening with Pinklin Thomas. I didn't see it live. I saw it on HBO, but it was live on HBO. And it was very, very difficult for me, now that I know Mike Tyson.
Oh, because you were worried that he'd get hurt?
I don't know what to say. In a sense, nobody worries that Mike Tyson's going to get hurt. He's an excellent defensive boxer. I can't analyze it. Just that now that I know him, I have a different feeling about boxing because the aesthetic distance, let's say, is more or less erased if you know somebody.
I think a sport like boxing is really changed by whether you're watching it at home on TV, whether you're actually in the ring with the cheering crowds.
Mm-hmm.
Which place do you prefer to be? You know, in the arena or at home?
Well, they're completely different. First of all, if you watch television, you're not seeing the real fight, but seeing a kind of cosmeticized version of it. And it's framed by the television screen, of course. You also have the voiceover of the announcers who impose a kind of narrative on something that's happening without any language. Boxing matches are completely silent, like most sports activities. And the narrator, the announcers, impose a narration on it that in some cases is misleading, but most of the time is very helpful, so that you have a sense of its being a story and having a movement to it and a kind of unity that you don't get when you're seeing it live. It's much less obviously brutal when it is brutal. You see it on television. Now, when you see it live, you're seeing something that is close to the thing in itself. But then because it's live, it moves very quickly, and you often don't know what your eye has seen. The eye takes in things that the brain can't really, really absorb or monitor. So there are advantages and disadvantages of both. I think ideally, when I was doing the Mike Tyson interview for Life magazine, ideally I saw a live fight, and then I was able to see it on tape, and I could see it over and over again several times, so that then I had the advantages of both media.
My guest is writer Joyce Carol Oates, and we're going to take a short break. We'll be back after this. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Joyce Carol Oates, and we're talking about the subject of her latest book, which is called On Boxing. I bet you feel lucky that you were exposed to boxing as a young girl, and I mean that in part because sometimes it's really good for a girl who might be exposed to all the, quote, female things, to be exposed to some of the, quote, male things to balance out her life.
Yes, absolutely. I think it allowed me a way into a kind of window into another world, very antithetical to my own. And then for many, many years, even for decades, it was more or less an abeyance because I didn't continue following the sport until a few years ago when I started researching a novel. And the novel was going to be is set in between the years 1946 and 1956. So I did a lot of research into the politics of the era, the McCarthy era, the Red Scare, the trial of the Rosenbergs, and so on and so forth. But the cultural element that I looked into was boxing, because the sport was so very much at its zenith at that time. It reached its zenith in the 20s with Jack Dempsey, then again in that era, with Rocky Marciano was the heavyweight title holder, and was sort of the end of Joe Louis's long reign. It was just very exciting, and millions of Americans watched boxing every week on television to a much greater extent, of course, than they do now.
When you were a girl, were boys surprised that you knew something about boxing and that you liked to watch it?
I don't really remember.
I remember the thing that scared me most about boxing was the whole idea of somebody's eye being razored open so that they could see. It still really appalls me.
Razored open?
Yeah. Cutting somebody's eye so that they can see out of it when it's been punched and it's all swollen, like in the film Rocky.
Oh, well, I don't think the film Rocky is any sort of...
They do that, don't they, though? Mm. I'd heard about that for years.
They don't do it, in my experience.
Really?
It doesn't seem to be part of what I know about boxing.
You've taken something of a feminist perspective on boxing in our culture. In what ways do you see your book as being feminist?
It was really informed by a feminist perspective. I was looking at what might be called a quintessentially masculine activity. In a sense, the boxers are almost parodies of masculinity. And I don't mean to suggest that all men are defined by boxing, because clearly they're not. But I was interested in it completely from the outside as a feminist, as a woman, with a kind of anthropological distance, or so I thought, though it was linked up emotionally with my own childhood. And I thought it would be much more critical of the sport and of those who surround it. But as I got into it, I saw really hundreds of fights on film and tape, and did a lot of reading. As I got more and more into it, I became more and more sympathetic with the boxers and with their predicament, so to speak, because they're in a certain economic context, of course. Jack Dempsey said, oh, there's only one thing a man fights for, and that's money. And virtually all boxers are from very impoverished backgrounds or ghetto neighborhoods, and they're fighting to raise themselves from these neighborhoods.
Yeah, there's two different sides to that particular coin. One is that it's really a blessing that if they're a good fighter, they can make a lot of money and get out of this really poor life. On the other hand, it almost feels like the message we're giving poor, especially blacks and Hispanics, mm-hmm. in America is, well, if you could fight well for our entertainment, you have mm-hmm. your ticket out.
Mm-hmm. It's very paradoxical. It's completely paradoxical, because there isn't any boxer, including Muhammad Ali, who would not have chosen boxing. Muhammad Ali, who now seems perhaps brain damage is too strong a word, but he suffers from something rather like Parkinson's disease. But Muhammad Ali made choices along the line, a choice of continuing to box when he was told by his physician he should stop boxing. And it seems to be a world. I'm trying to explore this in my novel, which is called You Must Remember This, and it's coming out in August. I'm trying to explore this from the point of view of a boxer who sees the ring as that one arena in life, perhaps the only arena in life, in which everything you do, every choice you make, has an immediate and opposite reaction. That is, you in the real world, in the world outside the ring, virtually, you know, all of what we do can be attributed to chance. Things are done to us, things happen accidentally. But in a sport like boxing, the man is all alone. He isn't even with a team. He's all alone in the ring, in a kind of nightmare exaggeration of the plight that we all have in terms of being alone. But his opponent's strength is really his own weakness. That is, if you have a very good defense and you've trained very well, you're in good condition, you probably can't be hurt. If you're a good boxer, then you're going to win your fight. If you're not so good, you shouldn't have gotten in the ring. So in the book, I was trying to explore the philosophical or psychological underpinnings of such a world, and I thought it was analogous almost to this harsh religions that we call Calvinistic, where everything you do is your own fault. At the same time, it's a completely predetermined world, which is this cruel, harsh God, rather like a Darwinian force.
Are you reaching different readers with your writing on boxing than you've ever reached with your novels and essays?
Yes, I think I'm reaching readers who don't read books, which is kind of a revelation to me that I have been invited to be interviewed by people who are basically interested in sports, sports writers. And I've gotten many letters from, virtually all letters from men. Some of them have been boxers and some are interested in boxing. I would guess that most of them don't read literary books at all and have no interest in literary books.
Is this refreshing for you?
It's interesting. It's surprising. My writer friends who are men, I have a lot of men writer friends, say that they're very jealous of me because they would have wanted to reach an audience like this. And I was interviewed by George Vexey of the New York Times.
The sports writer.
And my colleagues at Princeton were just terribly impressed with them because the sports pages are the pages that they really read and take seriously, whereas the book review is something that they find themselves in either because the books are reviewed or because they write for it themselves. So they don't find that quite as unusual.
I know readers of your novels frequently ask you about all the violence that appears in your novels. Do you see any connection between your interest in boxing and the sometimes violent explosions that take place in your books?
Well, some of these questions I think are in a way naive because I'm primarily a writer about America. And if I were a male writer, probably nobody would think my writing was violent. It just seems to be that there are certain preconceptions that women should be writing about tremulous states of being or in some kind of equivalent of needlepoint. And so when a woman writes simply about what's out there in the way that Norman Mailer does or Faulkner did or Melville and so on and so forth, and people seem to be surprised. But I'd say in both cases I'm primarily interested in a phenomenon that exists and by way of trying to understand it, to look at upon boxing, say, as a kind of symbol, and to use it as a window or a way into an understanding. I think that really is my primary impetus.
In a way, you live a pretty sheltered, isolated life. You live in Princeton in a home that I think's set back from a lot of the other houses. I don't know if you're surrounded by woods, but that's the impression I've gotten. And you teach at Princeton, but your writing is very much in the world in a lot of ways, not necessarily even in the century, but it seems almost a contradiction between your writing and your life, the isolation of your writing and the isolation of your life and the engagement of your writing.
There have probably not been very many writers. We could probably sit and name them, have we time, who've been completely immersed in the world, you know, very actively immersed. Hemingway comes most immediately to mind, but this was perhaps ultimately to his own detriment because he injured himself so many times. But I think the act of writing is an act of reflection and placing structure on experiences that might seem to be rather inchoate. So that if one is going to be a writer or, say, a poet, that by definition one is not going to be in the fray. However, like all human beings, I'm very much involved in happiness and unhappiness and chance and accident and various things that happen to us all simply by living. And my background in itself could be defined rather more as working class. It certainly wasn't that middle class.
Your husband runs a literary press. Now, I remember that you've said that you don't like him to read your writing, and I wonder if that's still the case, that he doesn't read your novels.
No, he doesn't read my writing. Sometimes he'll read a nonfiction essay or a review, but not the fiction. And it simply has worked out that way. I'm often asked that question as if it were something very strange. And I don't think of it as strange, but just that I need or I require some kind of private psychic space where someone whom I love very much and who is very close to me nonetheless doesn't have access to this particular space, which could be called the imagination.
Is it also so that you don't have to be living with a literary critic of your work?
That may well be. That may well be. We're so sensitive to criticism, even those of us who should know better.
It could kind of paralyze you, I think, if you've shown someone who you live with a chapter and they don't like it.
Exactly.
Then you have to feel like you're deluding yourself into thinking that it's good.
Yes, exactly. And it puts an unfair burden on that person because nobody really knows. There is no truth in art. There are only opinions.
One thing I have to ask you, you really are one of the most prolific writers in the country, I think. Do you write most hours of the day? And how do you keep it up? I know you must be asked that a lot. But.
Well, it doesn't seem to me that I'm that prolific because it seems to me I'm always going very slowly. Like this morning I may have done one page, and that seemed to come after great effort and strain. So I've sort of come to think that I inhabit different time from other people. The rhythm and the pace is just different.
How so?
That I work very slowly and take great pains and do a lot of revision, but then people on the outside think that I write very quickly. And there's some sort of mystery here which I will have to live with since I can't explain it.
Do you find time to read with all the writing that you do?
I read in the evenings.
Because I see a lot of your book reviews, so I figure you must.
Yeah, I enjoy reading very much. That's a kind of reward for the strain of writing. The writing is not easy.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Joyce Carol Oates, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Thank you for visiting with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been novelist and essayist Joyce Carol Oates, and her latest book is called Unboxing. It's published by Doubleday. This is Fresh Air.